in contrast to the view that others are just waiting for that opportunity to exploit us, when you are trusting of others, do you create a self-fulfilling prophecy? Most people, when you trust them, they are trustworthy in return, and those who are more inclined to trust wind up being happier at the end.
While we intuitively know that trust is critical to the development of professional and personal relationships, according to award-winning trust researcher Dr. Peter H. Kim, we consistently misjudge the trustworthiness of others. In this episode, Dr. Kim, author of How Trust Works, The Science of How Relationships Are Built, Broken, and Repaired, shares evidence-based insights he's gained over two decades of research. According to Kim, though we are quite willing to trust others, we are often more reluctant to forgive trust violations. And depending on the type of violation, strategies commonly used to repair trust, such as apologies, can be ineffective at best and at worst harm relationships. Dr. Kim is a professor of management and organization at the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business. His research has been published in numerous scholarly journals, and he's received both national and international awards. His work has been featured in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and on National Public Radio. Dr. Kim is senior editor for Organization Science, associate editor for Journal of Trust Research, and is on the editorial boards of Academy of Management Review and Negotiation and Conflict Management Research. Special thanks to today's host, Lori Murphy, Assistant Division Director for Executive Education at the Federal Judicial Center. Lori, take it away.
Well, welcome, Peter. We're so excited to have you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Peter, would you share with us why you decided to spend your career researching and studying the topic of trust?
Well, the truth is it hadn't been my original intent. I was primarily interested in how we view one another more generally, ourselves and others, and how those perceptions affect the way we relate to one another. And beyond that, how might we address those perceptions when they're wrong? But a lot of my focus was on three particular perceptions: competence, integrity, and power. And those things turned out to be critically important for trust. And so thinking about these issues through the lens of trust allowed me to tie everything together.
In your book, you suggest that most of us would say that trust is essential, and yet many of us define trust differently. So let's level set here. How do you define trust?
A widespread definition of trust in my field is a willingness to make oneself vulnerable to another based on positive expectations in situations involving risk. So those are comprised of multiple elements. It underscores a perceptual part, right? So it's not just behavior. It's your belief that someone is worthy of trust. It also requires an element of risk that you need to make yourself vulnerable and choose to make yourself vulnerable when things might go wrong.
So you've got the perception, you've also got the behavior. You really have an element of choice there as well. So tell us what that looks like.
In a workplace setting, we typically determine whether or not trust is there through the behavior someone might exhibit. So whether there's cooperation and agreement to work together. And that's actually how the social sciences thought about trust for a long time, through the behaviors. This is a very economics-oriented view. If you behave together, if you cooperate together, then you are trusting. If you don't, then you are not trusting. But the problem with that approach is that there are many situations in which you'll behave with someone else, you'll cooperate with them even if you don't trust them. For example, if you believe that there are monitoring systems or sufficient punishment or enforcement mechanisms in place to prevent someone from taking advantage of you or acting in an untrustworthy way, you'll cooperate with them, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you trust them. It simply means that you believe that you're safeguarded from them taking advantage.
So we can't just use behavior as our guidepost, because behavior alone is not determinative of whether there is trust between two people.
There are all sorts of reasons you might behave in a certain way that has little to do with even the person you're relating to. That's what the science has tried to address, that confounding factor when we've tried to explore trust. What is trust? How does that really operate? And how do you manage it?
Can you talk about the perception of competence versus perception of integrity and how those two factors play into how trustworthy someone is perceived?
That is probably one of the most important distinctions, whether or not someone has the skills, the ability to perform their job or task, and whether they adhere to principles we find acceptable, are considered the most important determinants of trust in all sorts of settings, whether it's with a supervisor or a coworker or a subordinate and so on. It turns out that we have these odd quirks in our mental basement that leads us to believe some kinds of information is more informative than other kinds of information. And that's where the attribution of competence or integrity can make a huge difference, because the biases we have about each type of trait can be quite different.
How do our brains perceive violations of competence differently than violations that are considered due to integrity?
So for competence violations, we exhibit a positive bias. And by that, I mean that we tend to weigh positive information about competence more heavily than negative information about competence. So if you're a baseball player, for example, and you hit a home run, you're considered a home run hitter, even though you might strike out afterwards. So that one instance of positive information is considered really informative. And we discount that negative information because we believe that all sorts of things can prevent even highly competent people from performing well. Maybe the sun was in his eye. Maybe there was an injury. There are all sorts of reasons why competent people may not perform well in a given instance. But for matters of integrity, that bias is reversed. We have a negative bias towards integrity. This means that we weigh negative information about integrity much more heavily than positive information about integrity. So if you are caught embezzling once and you don't embezzle the next day, you're still an embezzler in the eyes of others. That positive instance where you didn't embezzle is not considered very diagnostic. And it's because we believe that ethical people would never behave in that way. The only people who would engage in that act are truly unethical. And so that instance is considered really informative. On the flip side, it also means that attempting to address those violations is much harder for integrity violations, because we're going to discount any signal that you've taken corrective action, you intend to avoid this in the future. We just see this as uninformative because there are lots of cases in which unethical people choose not to do something wrong. For example, if they think they're going to get caught, they're not going to engage in that act. So we discount those positive acts.
What you're saying is when someone is perceived to be unethical, they are perceived to be untrustworthy, and it is very difficult to come back from that.
It really gets to how we define integrity. Does the other person adhere to principles you find acceptable? And that is very much associated with whether or not they are ethical, moral people. That is a huge determinant of whether or not they have integrity or not in our eyes. Despite how important we consider trust to be, how essential virtually all of us would say trust is in our lives, we actually manage this judgment quite poorly. We often make those judgments based on what we're motivated to think than the person's actual trustworthiness. On the one hand, we can make these evaluations based on the evidence at hand. What is the objective truth here? It turns out that the objective truth of the situation is just a small part of the story. There's a subjective truth. There's a social truth. The way you are interpreting the situation, the way you perceive other people, before you've even interacted with them, whether or not They come from your same hometown, went to the same school, what they do for a living. All those little cues can make such an enormous difference in the trust we exhibit. That's the arena in which I do a lot of my work. What is the social dynamic? What are the perceptions that really drive this fundamental question of whether or not they're actually trustworthy? There may be a truth there, but the way we derive that truth can be skewed in all sorts of ways.
I want to ask you about the hive mind, which impacts trust between or among groups. Would you tell us about that?
Definitely. The hive mind points to the fact that the way we respond to one another in a group setting can be very different. One of the things the creation of groups does is it leads us to view people differently. So people who are in our groups, we see in more favorable terms than people outside our groups. And we also have a motivation, a greater motivation to preserve relationships with people within our groups and those outside our groups. And this has huge influence on the stories we tell about why something might have happened. And so if someone in our own group commits a violation, we see this as a fluke, a matter of competence, not necessarily diagnostic, and just a mistake of the individual. But if it's done by someone in an other group, we see that same violation as more intentional and a matter of integrity and representative of the broader group, because we are less likely to differentiate members of the out-group than members of our in-group. And the other element that stokes the fires of this problem is that we tend to share our opinions with those like ourselves. For example, like the members of our own group, as we evaluate something that an out-group member did, and that tends to make our views and our impressions of what happened even more extreme. So rather than seeming like a borderline ethical decision, we believe it's even more unethical as a result of sharing these opinions with others in our own group. And so that just exacerbates the problem. That's a real problem, because you're just going to be more confident about the validity of your view when that may not necessarily be the case. And you'll have more confidence, you'll become more extreme in that opinion. It just makes it even harder to reconcile problems between groups.
I'd like to get a little more specific about work settings. Let's say a supervisor is needing to give some corrective feedback to someone who's worked for them for a number of years and will likely work for them for some time to come. What elements impact trust between them?
One element is whether the feedback meets the recipient's expectations or not. And so that feedback could meet it. It could be more positive than the recipient expected, or it could be less positive. Much of the action is when it's less positive. And the question is, you know, what happens when it's less positive? A lot depends on people's construal of the situation. Why is that feedback negative? So you might attribute it to the fact that you are actually deserving of that negative feedback, or the person may just not be good at conveying feedback. Another might be that they are setting you up, creating this history in order to fire you. They may have an agenda. So there are all kinds of stories you could tell about why that feedback is being given. And then there's this additional question of, okay, so how do I view my relationship with that supervisor? Because that adds another element of, well, am I invested in this relationship or not? And if you're invested in the relationship, if you really want to make it work, then you will make more favorable attributions. But if you don't have much invested in the relationship, if you don't really care, you're about to walk out the door anyway, then that motivation's gone. And so suddenly the types of stories you tell could be quite different.
So the stories that we tell are really important, and two people can walk away with very different stories that they're telling themselves.
This is where we may be completely wrong, right? It may not track with the story in the supervisor's own head for why this feedback is being conveyed. That's what complicates this whole puzzle.
How do I know if I have breached trust? And if so, if I've breached trust in the competence realm or the realm of integrity?
The truth is that we don't really know. So sometimes others may need to tell us. If others don't share the view that that was appropriate and they're disappointed in our actions, then they may see that as a trust violation. So we may not be aware of that. And then as far as the stories that we tell about why this happened, that can differ quite a bit. So we may think that, look, I screwed up. I didn't mean for this to happen, but it's very easy for others to have a very different view, to see that as a matter of integrity.
So if I violated trust in a way that is not living up to the value of integrity, what might I do in response to that?
That is the million-dollar question that has kept me poking at the bear in a way. Because once you see something as a matter of integrity, it's incredibly difficult to overcome. So all the standard responses we think should be effective, apologizing, assuming full responsibility for what happened, subsequent acts of penance, it turns out that that's not going to be as helpful because we're going to discount those positive signals after an integrity breach. So there are a couple of things that my work suggests could be viable in certain situations. One is to work on changing the narrative. So maybe it's not necessarily a matter of integrity. Others see it as a matter of integrity, but that might be wrong. Many violations are not so clear-cut. They might contain elements of both competence and integrity, and many acts are in between. How do we view someone who embezzles the money to pay for someone's medical bills, to save someone's life? How do we make those sorts of judgments? One of the things that the book underscores is that there are cases in which you can shift the attribution. People tend to make very snap judgments about why things have happened, and they don't necessarily gather all the relevant evidence to really understand why something might have happened. So in those cases, there may be an opportunity to convey that information, to really shift it out of the integrity box into the competence box. That's not something that's easy to do. A lot of times people are resistant to those reframing efforts. And that may mean that you may have limited success doing it on your own. But if others around you seem like impartial, neutral perceivers in the situation, they may have more influence on that view. And then the other avenue is to really tackle more directly this view that the act itself was a signal of low integrity. In the real world, there are lots of moral principles that we all share, but we might prioritize those principles a little bit differently in different situations and based on the information we have. An example would be, let's say you laid off some workers in your organization. They may see this as a real ethical breach, people that really counted on those jobs. But if you were to explain that this was necessary in order for you to prevent laying off even more people down the line, that may resonate as not necessarily so bad with respect to this integrity judgment. We tend to believe that leaders have a lot more control over what happens than they really do. That ultimately makes them far more likely to face the accusation of low integrity. They intended to do this. We see it wrong as wrong, and so we believe they lack integrity. But to the extent that they can highlight that this was not as volitional as it might seem, and they explain this being outside their hands, that would be very helpful.
I see this with leaders who, for confidentiality reasons, is not at liberty to say much. And I can imagine that there could be a perception that the leader is less trustworthy because they're not sharing information. They're not doing anything about the situation.
It really touches on two things. One, when you don't divulge, if you don't offer a response, people are going to fill in the blanks for you, and they're not necessarily going to do it in a way that's helpful to you. I do have work that's in the book that talks about the downsides of not saying anything. No response is indeed the worst response of all. And then that particular example is nice in the sense that it really does illustrate how this kind of situation can indeed be beyond that leader's control. People are very inclined to believe that this was a deliberate act. And even to keep them in the dark is something that is deliberate simply because they did not explain in a way that prevents those kinds of negative attributions. I can do that rather easily in my research. Just tell people a different narrative and they don't necessarily have much stake in one narrative or the other. And so they'll just accept the narrative I give them. But a lot of times people do have a stake in the narrative that they hold, and that maybe through past experience or certain motivations to view the world in one way or the other. And that's where things become much more challenging. There's a tendency to believe that leaders are powerful and have control simply because they have control over you. But if you highlight the fact that they are just in the middle of this big hierarchy, and that can help underscore the fact that they don't have as much power as you think. So rather than changing the attribution of competence and integrity, you can actually shift the attribution of how much power they have. That is a very different story than they might have initially come up with themselves, because people tend to be very egocentric in how they view these situations. If that person has more power over you, you believe that person has power, and then you broadly generalize that power to everything. But that's something you can tackle in a more meaningful way.
Repairing trust, which is a lot of what we've been talking about, it sometimes does involve apologizing for something we've done. And your research suggests that many of us aren't good at giving an apology or accepting apologies, and sometimes an apology is not really helpful.
The challenge with apologies is that they are double-edged in nature. The upside of apologies is that you are conveying remorse, and through that, an intention to redeem yourself. But the downside of an apology is that it also confirms guilt. And the question then becomes, well, which is more important, the signal of redemption or the confirmation of guilt? And it turns out that we weigh those signals differently depending on the type of violation. So this is where the type of attribution can make an enormous difference. If you see the violation as a matter of integrity, that same apology that might have been very helpful for a competence violation winds up being harmful or doing no good at all, because you have confirmed that you lack integrity, and people are going to discount these positive signals of redemption that signal of remorse might convey. And that's the conundrum that trips up both the would-be apologizer and the recipient of the apology, because the would-be apologizer, they are trying to mitigate this double-edged nature of that message, and so they tend to not offer full apologies. And then for the recipients of the apology, if they receive that apology for an integrity-based violation, they're actually punishing the person for conveying it. This is a real problem in the sense that if I were to ask most people how important is an apology, most people would say that it's especially important after an integrity-based violation. But if they do offer that apology, we wind up hating them even more. And so we're creating the worst incentives for that kind of response.
All right, Peter, you got to give us some good news here. I know your research shows that integrity violations are very difficult to come back from, but do you see hope? And what can you leave our listeners with on that score?
There's a lot of hope. The upsides here are that people are not as untrustworthy as we tend to believe. You know, most of us believe that trust starts at zero and only builds gradually over time as we get to know one another. It turns out we actually convey a lot of trust in people we don't know for precisely the reasons that we hinted at earlier. There are all sorts of cues that can lead us to believe others are trustworthy. And so that is a tendency that we have. And it turns out that that's not a foolish tendency. It actually makes us better off because in contrast to the view that others are just waiting for that opportunity to exploit us, when you are trusting of others, you create a self-fulfilling prophecy. They don't see this as an opportunity for exploitation. They see that trust as a precious resource to preserve for the future. So they want to prove you right. And so that's the dynamic that's created. Most people, when you trust them, they are trustworthy in return. And those who are more inclined to trust wind up being happier at the end.
Peter, where can we learn more about you and your work?
There are two places on the web I would point you to. First, I have a website, peterhkim.com, that contains a variety of details about the book and reviews and podcasts and articles that have been written about this topic. So that's one source. And then you can also find me at my university website, the University of Southern California, Marshall School of Business. If you just do a Google search with those terms and my name, I should pop up with the latest things I'm working on today.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Peter. This has been a fantastic conversation. I've learned a lot, so I appreciate it.
Well, I really enjoyed the conversation, Lori. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Lori, and thanks to our listeners. To hear more episodes of this podcast, visit the podcast link at fjc.dcn/EE. You can also listen and subscribe to this podcast via Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. All episodes are also available on fjc.gov. In Session, Leading the Judiciary is produced by Shelley Easter. Our program is supported by Angela Long, Jamie Mitchell, and the entire studio and live production team. Thanks for listening. Until next time, this podcast was produced at U.S. taxpayer expense.